Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Nancy D. Campbell, professor in the Department of Science and Technology Studies and Associate Dean for Graduate Studies and Research at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Campbell, who earned a PhD in the History of Consciousness program at UC Santa Cruz, did her master's in English at the University of Washington, a bachelor's in English at Bucknell. She has researched and published on topics such as drug addiction, bioethics, public health, and drug policy, and feminist and postcolonial science and technology studies. Dr. Nancy Campbell, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So the reason I did invite you, Nancy, if I may call you that, is the question of drug addiction and why it happens. You've become quite a student of that issue and have been doing very interesting work, and maybe we can figure it out together.
Well, let's give it a try. Drug addiction has certainly bedeviled the United States since the 19th century. We still have many problems with it today. They take different shape, different form, different populations, and yet the addiction issue remains with us. It's a perennial issue. Why does it happen? When you really ask me that, I have to think, well, why do people seek experiences that are outside of the ordinary? Why do people feel like they're in pain, whether that pain is economic, whether it's physical, whether it's mental? People are seeking medication. People are seeking a substance that can help them do something that for some reason they themselves, their lives, their brains, their bodies can't do. And so I think people turn to these substances out of real needs.
Real need could be that they're in pain, and so therefore they need something to cover the pain. So we know there are all kinds of addictions. There are drug addictions, there are sexual addictions, there are all the rest of that stuff. But it's not as if, you know, we're talking Timothy Leary in the old days, you know, LSD, and you can have a greater level of consciousness. It's often one of the most non-productive things that any human being can do to themselves.
Indeed, but you have to ask, why? You really do have to go to why on earth would someone engage in something that's unhealthy, non-productive, and really a behavior that will affect and have negative consequences in many sectors of a person's life. Why do people do that? I've recently been reading the work of Gabor Mate in British Columbia, who wrote a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, and who really goes deeply into childhood experiences and attachment and the difficulties that people have in forming relationships with parents and with other important people in their lives. And I've been persuaded by some of it. I'm interested in the fact that there are behavioral addictions, these addictions that are not substance-oriented.
So give us an example of what a behavioral addiction
is. So something like gambling, something like compulsive shopping, some of the kinds of things even that you or I might do. I myself am probably a compulsive book buyer. And you really have to think about, well, what is that giving the person who's engaging in that experience? And they may well not be thinking about the consequences that they might be having on other people around them, because they're interested in an experience that is somehow relieving a condition of pain that they're encountering in their everyday lives. So, for instance, back in the 19th century and early 20th century, you saw many white women, upper and middle class women, sometimes working class women, who were dependent on opiates. And they were dependent on opiates because their physicians were giving them access often to morphine. And the reasons for that were many, myriad, because physicians had an effective treatment. That was one reason. For a variety of conditions that people faced in the 19th and early 20th centuries, before morphine and heroin were criminalized, you had a large addiction problem in the United States.
Well, we give morphine in hospitals. We don't give heroin in hospitals.
Exactly. Now, heroin, of course, is an interesting drug because Bayer, the makers of Bayer aspirin, put it on the market in 1898, partly as an addiction treatment and partly because...
So, in other words, they used heroin then as we use alternative drugs to heroin now?
Exactly. So morphine was a drug that by the turn of the 20th century, many physicians knew was causing a problem of some kind. Now, we didn't use the term addiction in the United States until about that time.
And what year was that?
About 1899 or so, you begin to hear physicians talking about this problem of addiction. And in the early 20th century, the American Medical Association, the AMA, did an investigation into morphine, and they concluded that there were certain uses for which morphine was indispensable. However, they were also very concerned about overprescription of morphine because the main vector of addiction in the 19th century and early 20th century was physicians. In other words, these were what we would call medical addicts or iatrogenic addicts. They were on a drug that was prescribed by a physician. They became tolerant to it, and they became unable to function without it. And so when they were deprived of the drug, they went into withdrawal. They often felt ill. They often felt like they were getting the flu. And they realized that they needed to seek morphine again, or tincture of opium, laudanum, the other kinds of opiates that were available on the market. But the fact was that these people did not pose any threat to the public health. So no one thought of them as particularly problematic. And so that vast army, really, of women who were maintained on morphine by their physicians in the 19th century were not considered to be drug addicts. They weren't considered to be problematic.
Now, you say there was no threat to the public health, Professor Campbell. Explain that to me. In other words, today, do we consider populations that are black and poor to be threatening to the public health?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. There was a change in the mid-20th century that really, prior to the early 1950s, you did not see many black or poor people addicted to opiates. You saw mainly white, and actually during the 40s, you saw many more men become addicted to morphine and heroin, etc. You begin to see the concern, and it wasn't necessarily a public health concern, it was a concern about behavior. You begin to see that concern in the 1910s, and heroin and morphine, narcotics, are actually criminalized in 1914 by an act called the Harrison Act. Many of the states, New York included, had many Harrison Acts already on the books even before 1914. So right around that period, we begin to see problematic behaviors developing, particularly around heroin. And heroin is, within 5 years of being on the market, heroin is known to be addictive, and it's known to be something that physicians should avoid giving to their patients. And people begin to realize there's this euphoria, there's a rush with heroin that many people don't experience so definitively as with morphine. And so heroin becomes the target of U.S. drug policy really from 1914 on.
And where was it manufactured?
Heroin was aspirin, morphine, all analgesics. There were U.S. manufacturers of all of these drugs.
And we grew the poppies here?
No, we didn't grow the poppies here, but the poppies, opium poppies, are of course necessary for morphine base as well. So morphine, you still have to have the actual opium poppy in order to make morphine and in order to make some of the derivatives of those kinds of drugs. In fact, our inventions of our attempts to get away from having to rely on poppies have led to many other drugs going onto the market. So back to the heroin problem, in the 1910s and 1920s, the enforcement of the Harrison Act fills up our prisons, overcrowds our prisons, and the prison wardens, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, begins to get very concerned about all of these drug addicts sort of filling up the prisons and making everything overcrowded. And at the same time, you begin to see that massive middle class and upper middle class kind of addiction to morphine begin to go out of style. Because once you criminalize something, people who are deeply invested in class privilege don't want to have anything to do with it. So there's beginning to be a sporting or recreational use of heroin in the early 20th century. And it's that small amount of use that begins to grow and grow and grow. And it increases in size through the 20th century. And it becomes something towards which the authorities become more and more punitive over time. And as we see, class and race privilege migrates. And so you don't see, you begin to see addicts becoming more and more from the poorer and from racial ethnic groups. And there are a variety of racial ethnic groups. So you begin to see concerns in the 1950s, right after World War II, because during World War II, a lot of the opiates were not available on the streets in this country. People were using tinctures, highly dilute forms of the opiates. But opium is considered a strategic material, and so it was stockpiled during the war. So there wasn't a whole lot of it out there. And people began to turn to other drugs like Demerol and Dilaudid and other things that would be available from physicians during that time. When heroin again hits the streets after World War II, it is cheaper, it is more available to a larger group of people. And by then, your sort of respectable addicts are no longer engaging in opiate use. And so the unrespectable addict population begins to grow and grow. And that's what you see in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
So you're a historian, you're an expert in bioethics. Let me ask you this. Is it your sense that we have created, every time we make something illegal, we create, prohibition being the prime example, we create a market, an absolute market for criminals to do their wear?
Yes, and you also create an enforcement mechanism that's interested in perpetuating itself. And police, law enforcement, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in this case comes into being after right around the time of the repeal of prohibition. And so, indeed, you see the creation of illegal markets, even for legal commodities, interestingly.
For example?
For example, the legally available opiates, the prescription drugs, right? Today, we have a huge, basically illegal market in legal pharmaceuticals. And because of the restrictions and regulations around how legal pharmaceuticals are prescribed, you see people managing their addictions, managing their own drug use by turning to the illegal market, which is called diversion. And so you begin to see the formation of those kinds of markets in the mid-20th century as well, around substances like in the 1950s, everybody who's on antidepressants or benzodiazepines today were on minor tranquilizers. These were things like Miltown and Librium. They're not big names today, but at the time, they were what you used to medicate oftentimes your middle-class ills. And so if you remember, in the 1950s, there was a pill-popping culture that began to take shape around also cocktail use. So you'd have pills, alcohol, et cetera. You'd have legal and illegal commodities all mixing in there together.
And what year was that? I'm sorry, Nancy.
Well, Milltown, those are 1957, 58, 59, 60, and they really command a large market share until along come Valium, the benzodiazepines. And again, those drugs command a large market share until along come effective antidepressants. And so you do see people in this country turning to both legal and illegal substances and not always being aware that they're mixing them. In other words, polydrug use begins, especially in the 1970s, you begin to see an attention to polydrug use. And you see that both within the respectable and within the so-called dangerous classes.
So in other words, I'm sorry for interrupting, but let me ask you this. Somebody goes to a doctor prescribes one of these drugs, and they get addicted from what they're getting in the physician's office, and then they go searching on the outside for other stuff.
Exactly. They may have learned also that the substance that they are most loyal to might have effects that they also need to medicate for. And so even in the 50s, you'd find people who were on heroin who would turn to cocaine at times. Or you would find people who learned that certain drugs would attenuate and make the effects of another drug longer lasting. And so we still see that today, particularly with the benzodiazepines. So
you've used that word several times. Can you tell us?
So benzos are a drug that are essentially anti-anxiety drugs.
Do they have names that we might recognize?
Well, Valium would be the first one that we would recognize. But today, and I'm not good with today's benzodiazepines, but there's a whole sort of buffet out there of anti-anxiety drugs that people use to reduce nervousness in professional settings. But they also use them because there's stress and pain and anxiety in all of our lives. And if there's something that takes the edge off that, you might well do it. There are also off-label uses. Physicians might prescribe a beta blocker, for instance, in order to medicate for an anxiety condition. And so there are lots of reasons that people turn to these drugs that really have to do with managing their lives and not with recreation.
But they can ruin their lives even though they're trying to manage their lives.
Exactly. As we all know, sometimes management can go too far and get us into trouble. And so if people do develop tolerance to these drugs, they essentially do suffer a discontinuation syndrome when they discontinue the drugs. It's not called withdrawal on your patient package insert, but it is effectively a form of withdrawal. And so I think a lot of people are out there managing these kinds of conditions in ways that people have in the past.
I want to mention, Professor Campbell, two things. One is Sherlock Holmes, and the other is Woody Allen. Now, Sherlock Holmes, we know from the books, was addicted to heroin, or used it. In any case, and we do also know that Woody Allen, in one of the great films, and I can't remember which one it was, somebody faints and they said, get a Valium. Does anybody have a Valium? And there's this huge crowd standing around and everybody has a handout. So that one, he was talking about, you know, the fact that it was just everywhere at the time.
Yes, these drugs are ubiquitous. And I guess the point that I'm trying to make here
yes.
is that there's not that much difference between what people are doing who don't have access to legal pharmaceuticals and what people are doing who do. In other words, people are trying to manage to regulate their emotions, their moods, their mental states. Sometimes they're trying to respond to physical problems and difficulties, disabilities. Sometimes they have chronic pain conditions. Sometimes they are actually ill. And in all of those cases, people are using these drugs as tools or technologies to manage the conditions of their everyday lives. Because of the way that historically we've drawn a line, we've criminalized some of those substances and some of those uses and some of those populations, and we have essentially given a pass to others, we haven't really recognized as a society that we've produced conditions that essentially require many of us to regulate them artificially. In other words, we haven't really looked introspectively at what could we do to reduce the amount of pain and anxiety and stress that a lot of people are facing in their lives. And that's kind of the point.
We are talking to Dr. Nancy D. Campbell, professor in the Department of Science and Technology Studies, associate dean for graduate studies and research at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Nancy, I want to talk economics a little bit with you. To some degree, you said something I considered to be profound. It is that groups get in on it in the same way we have a prison system now. You're in the system. There are whole towns now that are experiencing a huge deficit of jobs because we are making drug addicts easier to get out I know that's inarticulate to get out, and so therefore you don't have enough people. You don't need as many people. You don't need as many prisons to do that. There's one example. The other, I've always thought, is giving doctors the right to prescribe. And so basically we have said to our MDs, arbitrarily, you can give this stuff out, no one else can. And when the PhDs come along and say, let us give it out, they say, no, you don't know anything, you don't know your biology, and therefore you can't do it. So everybody gets a stake in the system somehow by preserving some of these rules.
Exactly. Now, prescriptions weren't that common in the United States until the 1950s. The opiates and Schedule I narcotics, as we would think of them today, were prescription only after 1914. So the power to prescribe has meant different things to different people at different times. Economically, it's been a huge monopoly privilege that physicians have. But I do think that pharmacology is not a simple science. And in fact, medical doctors aren't necessarily as fully trained in pharmacology, i.e. the basic science of pharmacology, as they could be. And so there are high rates in this country of medical error around drug interactions and adverse drug reactions. That is something, even overdoses, frankly, that is something that we really, I think, do need to take a harder look at. So I don't think that everybody should have the right to freely prescribe, or every profession should have the right to prescribe all of these drugs. However, it does seem to me like we do need to look at the way that pharmacological expertise is distributed in our society and begin to make popular education materials, for instance. I mean, why isn't every opiate addicted person in this country supplied with a narcotic antagonist? We've known how to reverse narcotic overdose since 1951. It's been pretty clear.
And what are some of those antagonists?
The one that's mostly out on the market now is Narcan or Naloxone. And these are drugs that can be administered by addicts who see other people getting into trouble or even self-administer. There's intranasal Narcan at this point. And so in this country, there have been a group of people called harm reductionists who have tried to say that the way we should handle drug policy issues, especially with the amount of prescription opiates that are out there, both legally and illegally, we should reduce the social, economic, and health consequences of drug use. Now, other people disagree with harm reductionists, particularly people who are conservatives, cultural conservatives, will not condone the reduction of harm because they feel that that would, in fact, encourage more people to use opioid drugs and to get into trouble with them. Now, harm reductionists don't feel that way. They basically feel we ought to put the hand, if we can prevent preventable deaths from overdose. Overdose rates in this country are much higher than they should be. If we can prevent those kinds of deaths, then we should do that. We should put narcotic antagonists in the hands of people who are addicted, train them to use them on themselves and on others.
But easier said than done. Obviously, they're taking the narcotic, as you said, started out the program, in order to mask other kinds of pain. Now you're saying to them, okay, here's the antagonist. Use this and you won't be addicted anymore. So who wants to do that? Or we want to continue to cover the pain?
Well, I think that's part of the issue, Alan, is that if people are in a fair amount of denial of what it is that they're covering over, they're going to continue to do that, and they may not willingly accept a narcotic antagonist. That's not necessarily what's happening. What we're actually seeing is that people who are addicted to opioid drugs will actually help each other out. They will prevent when an overdose situation occurs, instead of abandoning somebody at an emergency room door, they will actually administer a narcotic antagonist and reverse that overdose. And that's, I think, what we want to build into the culture of opiate addicts. And here we're just talking about basically people who are using heroin, people who are using OxyContin, IV drug use, that is a dangerous kind of situation. People can certainly learn how to administer those drugs. Why can't they also learn how to administer a narcotic antagonist? Makes sense to me. And then you have far few people dying.
There are those people, Dr. Campbell, who will think that that's a Pollyannish approach, that in fact, you know, easier said than done. But let me reintroduce you so everybody knows we're talking with a fabulous guest, Dr. Nancy D. Campbell, professor in the Department of Sociology and Technical Studies, associate dean for graduate studies and research at RPI. So I guess the next question that I wanted to get into was, and it follows, I think, pretty much on the harm reductionist argument and others that may be antithetical, but we have people like Congressman Charlie Rangel and others who are saying, you know, make drugs free. What is all of this other stuff? If she, you know, people have to rob to get them and the rest of it, either make them free or at least don't penalize them, don't criminalize them.
So there's been a many periods in American history when there have been efforts to legalize and when there have been high-level policy discussions about the legalization of some of these substances. And it seems to me that it's important to understand that we shouldn't lump them all together. In other words, some of these substances are highly dangerous and really do need to be regulated in a different way than some of the others. Some patterns of use are more dangerous than others.
So put names on those.
Well, even, you know, it seems to me like the decriminalization, limited decriminalization of some substances, for instance, the psychedelics or hallucinogens, have therapeutic uses. What we have done since the late 1960s is basically say, no, they have no therapeutic use whatsoever.
Well, that was certainly my impression, but what therapeutic uses are you thinking of?
Well, so there have been many scientific studies at this point using these in different kinds of psychiatric settings, using them in cases of terminal illness, of chronic pain, in which it's been revealed that some of these kinds of substances actually really make for breakthrough, often self-transformative experiences.
So now, we're talking about LSD, something like
we're
that?
We're talking about psilocybin, LSD, MDMA, i.e. ecstasy, etc. Now that use, a controlled, delimited use confined to certain forms of psychiatric therapy is very different from using those drugs in the context of a party or a rave or a club or a setting in which there's no possibility really of controlled use, but there is a possibility for safer or less harmful use. And so it seems to me that you have to look at what the drugs are, what the settings are, what the user population is, in order for you to decide, well, okay, how can we make the people in this setting, this type of person, have a safer, less harmful kind of experience, right? So it seems to me like you have to actually separate out the drugs. You can't regulate them altogether. So there's a difference between medical marijuana and non-medical marijuana, but it's blurry because some of the people who are using marijuana non-medically might actually be using it to medicate for some of the problems that we were talking about earlier. And so you really, I think, have to make a much more context-specific judgment of what's the person using this drug for and go from there. Now, I know that's hard to do in terms of policy, and it's hard to do in terms of how people access these substances. Because if we're talking about an illicit market, we're talking about a whole bunch of other behaviors, criminal behaviors may be involved. And so that's where I think we need to see greater cooperation between law enforcement and public health and medicine.
Yeah, well, it's easier said than done. Every once in a while, we'll open up one of the tabs and see some doctor's been arrested for massive selling of these drugs, which he has or she has a right to get to.
Exactly. And the problem of how to deal with controlling drug use among pharmacists and physicians has long been one. I was in the New York State Archives yesterday noticing that in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the state was concerned with that problem quite specifically. What that really shows you is that exposure matters, right? If a drug is available to a certain population, there's going to be a small percentage of that population who's going to use it problematically or prescribe it problematically, get into trouble with it in one way or another. And so I do think that we do have to regulate and control at that level. The question is, what about the broader, wider spread use of much less problematic drug use?
So what about the idea of making drugs legal?
Well, I'm not particularly a proponent of legalization. It seems to me like, again, I think I used to be, but I think as a historian, as I've learned the incredible resourcefulness of addicts, I think I've also learned a lot more about some people's appetite for risk. I do think that there do need to be controls. The question, though, about what happens to people who run afoul of those controls is near and dear to my heart, because I don't really think that people need to be, I don't think punishment and deterrence necessarily work as well as they have been given credit for, especially when we're talking about underlying problems like the lack of jobs where people live. I mean, the illicit drug economy might be the best enterprise available in a certain geographic area, and the only one. Oh, it means that if there are no legitimate businesses in an area that are providing jobs for the people who are out there selling drugs and basically working within the drug manufacturing sort of setting, what are you going to do? If there aren't legitimate activities, if there aren't satisfying, interesting activities, good work, I guess is how I would put it, if good work is unavailable, are we that surprised that people turn to the illicit economy and engage in it as they would? These people would be very successful in legitimate enterprise, but they often, the barriers to entry are too high, and you've got an area that's basically been colonized by the illicit drug economy. We have seen that over and over and over. There was a famous essay written by an anthropologist who was studying New York in the late 50s called Taking Care of Business. And it was an anthropology of drug addicts and drug dealers. And it basically showed that people were getting out of bed, getting up and getting out of bed to take care of business, i.e. participate in the illicit economy, because it was who they were, and because it was there was a lack of legitimate activity in that area.
Nancy Campbell, I leave my home, I drive an hour to get here to Albany, and I hate to say this because I don't want to tick anybody like the mayor off or anybody else, but when I'm coming in and I go through the hood in order to get here, I see grown men on little bicycles handing each other little packages. There's no two ways about it, and it fits your description to the T. This is a difficult neighborhood, a challenged neighborhood, and this is the enterprise, because what else are you going to do?
It's also a difficult period in history. And so I think that we have to look at where drug economies take root. Mm-hmm. Who participates in them, because it's different people in different times. I mean, as we know, there's middle class and suburban drug use and drug trafficking. But urban drug trafficking has really taken hold, and historically in this country, from really the 1950s onward, that's what we see, the pattern that you just described. And it's unfortunate. In the old days, interestingly, drug addicts often had other businesses. They often worked in sort of low wage share jobs, not necessarily menial labor. Sometimes they had skilled work. And when youth entered the drug economy in the early 1950s, those more stable, more settled, less criminal drug addicts were displaced. And you begin to see a culture of violence begin to take hold particularly in the 70s and 80s, and particularly with the influx of cocaine. Cocaine, having once been as expensive as gold in the 1970s, falling in price and becoming much more widespread use, obviously, in the 80s through the medium of crack cocaine. And so you really have to think about the what drugs are available to whom at what time. Because it seems to me like the drug problem is different in different places, different people, different time periods.
How much do you think genetics plays into all of this? In other words, who's predisposed?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Part of my work has, in fact, been to tell the story of the history of the science of addiction research. And you don't see much emphasis on genetics until very late in the game. Many people will give you very high ballpark percentages. I tend to think much, much less genetic influence is necessarily involved, but there is some genetic influence involved. I look at that and think, well, I think that the social and economic and political aspects that lead people to be able to engage in a particular form of drug use matters a lot more than genetics. And genetics is also interesting because when we used to talk about gene environment, and now we talk a lot about gene environment interactions, and we talk about epigenetics, a word that essentially means that your social environment and your ways of relating to people can turn on or off the kinds of cascades that lead to genetic influences. And so we can actually mitigate genetic influences just as well as we can maximize them. And so we really have to look at the environments we're creating, the society that we are creating, in order to really talk about genetics. So genetics is an interesting kind of misnomer at this point in time, because it actually means interaction with parents and siblings. It actually means a whole lot more than just what's going on in your DNA.
You see a time when people will be tested in terms of the development of the genome for whether or not they're susceptible. We do it with cancer. We do it with breast cancer now. Is it possible we're going to do that in terms of, you know, a pediatrician saying to a mother, listen, Mrs. Schwartz, you may have a problem here because your kid has the marker.
Well, this is also, I think, we should dispel the idea that there is any one marker. The complex conditions of addiction and alcohol, they've been looking pretty hard. They're pretty good at what they do. Addiction and alcoholism are really complex the genetics are very complex. In other words, there's no one gene involved in these conditions, or I think we would have found it by now.
But every day we read in the paper that something else has been found.
Certainly. But I also think that there are some limits. There are some constraints in terms of what we're going to know. I do have tremendous privacy concerns about the idea that someone would be marked from a very young age as a potential addict or a potential alcoholic, even marked as a potential sufferer of ADHD or any of these kinds of conditions, any mental illness. It does seem to me like that really begins to cut to the core of our ideas of being human. Some of these conditions are part of who we are. They're part of our identity. And I don't mean to say that I think that people should just be allowed to move along and develop full-blown alcoholism. So there's a good reason, though, to know something about predisposition, and that's because you might well want to prevent. There are interventions, early interventions, to try to prevent the development of some of these kinds of conditions.
Like what?
Well, particularly around addiction, we're starting younger and younger in order to try to get parents and try to get children to understand something about how they're using these drugs. And it gets back to the conversation we were having earlier about harm reduction. And that is, you may well want to know that your user profile might be such that you might want to avoid certain substances, and you might want to develop relationships with others, right? So there may well be good reason to know earlier, particularly when there is that perfect storm of family history, you know, genetic influences, availability, exposure, right? You may well want to have a good idea about who might be at risk so that you can work with them in order for them to avert that risk in their lives.
But you're pretty certain, and this is fascinating to me, that we can take measures with that knowledge in hand to prevent the illness.
Well, let's see. I'm an adherent of the notion that we should not be criminalizing addicts. And so that means that I'm a proponent of the idea that we should take public health approaches, that medical doctors should be involved in the conversation, that we should have social measures in place in order to enable people to lead more satisfying lives, less painful, less anxious, less stressful, more satisfying lives.
So if now, I'm sorry, Nancy, but if we decriminalize, I want to stop you for a second. If we decriminalize and we tell the prison industry, go fish or do that kind of thing, what are the prohibitions that are available to us other than putting people in jail?
Well, we have social sanctions. We have, and I think social norms are very effective.
But you just got through saying one of the things you were really worried about was, you know, putting somebody on a list where they'll never get a job
sure.
again.
But what I'm concerned about is, why don't we teach people to use drugs and alcohol responsibly? Why don't we teach them how to control their use? Why don't we use the power of social norms and parenting, the power that we have as people who are related to other people, why don't we put that to positive use and make sure that people understand that it is possible for all but a very small percentage of people to control, to self-regulate, to control their own use of many of these substances, but not all. So there are some where I would just say, criminalize it and go ahead and make
Morphine?
Sure... No, certainly not morphine. Morphine has too many indispensable medical uses to be treated in that way.
Which way?
To be treated as criminalized.
Right.
Right. So what I would say is...
Do you ever have morphine?
Yes.
Me too. It was wonderful. I only had it once. I broke a lot of bones when I fell off a bicycle and I broke a lot of bones. The governor called the first day and said something, and they called the second day and he said, he called yesterday, I sound better. And I said, wait a second, are you telling me that you called me yesterday? And he said, are you on morphine? I said, yes. He said, I thought so. This is the clearest, most concise, most wonderful conversation I've ever had with you. Okay, so, but there are those people when they get that first shot of heroin, they get that first shot of morphine, that's it, goodbye.
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of people who have adverse experiences, even with one shot of morphine. There are people who don't like it. There are people who mm-hmm. have all kinds of difficult interactions or feel sick. Some people feel like it doesn't matter that they feel sick. It feels wonderful anyway. But of course, there are problems with morphine when you go off it. And those problems, right, discomfort, constipation, other problems of that kind that accompany the use of really of any opiate. Some people, for them, this isn't a wonderful experience. So what about the opiates? I mean, the opiates, I think, are too indispensable in medical practice to be criminalized. And illicit opiate use, clearly people are engaging in that typically because they have some other problems. And there obviously there's recreational opiate use. All of those uses are different. And to me, that means you treat them differently.
But wait,
you respond
wait.
To them differently.
But wait, let me just...
We now have drugs.
Sure.
So we have methadone, which is itself an opiate, and which we maintain people on because they're able to be more functional on it for decades.
Than on
right?
heroin. But on the other
than
hand,
on heroin.
There are also abuses of the methadone system.
There certainly are. There are abuses of methadone. Also, methadone is tightly regulated, and so in a way, it almost invites abuses. Today, we also have a drug called buprenorphine, or Suboxone, which is a mixture of naloxone, the narcotic antagonist I was talking about a long time ago. We're talking about Narcan. It's a mixture of buprenorphine and Suboxone. So Suboxone is a drug where if you really want to get out of the life of chasing after an opiate like heroin or OxyContin or Vicodin, you can turn to your physician, and a physician can now prescribe, if they're properly trained, because it's a complex drug to manage, a physician can prescribe buprenorphine if you are ready to make a break with that kind of life where you are constantly after shorter acting opiates. The trick is really, are you going to stay on buprenorphine according to your physician's instructions, right? Because these drugs have compliance issues. I mean, all drugs. I am not very good, I'll confess, at complying with drug regimens. I can't. I have a lot of difficulty, despite having a very orderly middle-class life. I can't seem to comply with drug regimens. It would be very difficult for me to be on a drug that I had to take every 4 hours in order to stay straight. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about heroin, when we're talking about, people who are on opioids. That's one of the reasons people like OxyContin, because it's longer acting. And so you've got a lot of folks out there who are basically in need of support, often pharmacological support, as well as other kinds of support, in order to manage their lives. Why don't we make sure that that is not criminalized, right? That management shouldn't perhaps be criminalized. They should be in a treatment system. They should be under the care of a physician. They should be in a prevention program if they're younger, et cetera.
Now, you're a historian. We've been through several cycles. Some of the stuff that happened much earlier is happening again right now. We see these cycles going. We haven't learned a whole hell of a lot. There is a libertarian philosophy, which is, okay, you know, people want to kill themselves, let them kill themselves. You know, they want to do whatever they want to do. What we're doing is we're creating this whole superstructure. It doesn't work. So, you know, just if it has to happen, let it happen. And you say?
Well, indeed, I've heard that argument even at the highest levels of the United States. We've heard that argument issue from, you could say President Reagan's Just Say No campaign was kind of predicated on that. And what I don't like about that is that it really devalues some people. It makes it seem like some people are expendable, like we can do without them. They're the dregs of society anyway. And what I'm interested in is a much more inclusive system.
Yeah, well, you're an egalitarian. I know you, Professor Campbell. Believe me, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, you know, give everybody a decent place to live, give everybody a good hospital, give everybody a good doctor. Yeah. But that isn't the way this country operates right now. So are we better off? The question then becomes, just saying, okay, it's really not helping. Just let everybody do what they want to do.
I wouldn't say anything goes either. So what I'm trying to argue for here is limited decriminalization of some substances. And then let's devote all the energy and money that goes into enforcement into the things that, one, we can effectively enforce. I don't think it's worth putting resources into things that are ineffective. And two, things that we think are really dangerous and that we pretty much all agree are dangerous uses of dangerous commodities. Then let's take the other commodities that aren't so dangerous and that people can use without grave harm to themselves or others, and let's treat them differently.
Okay, just in case somebody's driving along and wants to hear your list on both sides of this again, could you do it for us?
Okay, so we've got a bunch of drugs that people can use pretty safely, i.e. they've been through an FDA approval process, and they're legal drugs. They're out there on the illegal market, but
OxyContin, methadone?
All of those drugs.
Yeah.
We use within regulatory constraints, and we say they're safe. They can be used with minimal harm. In fact, they're healthier, and they allow people to be more functional
But somebody's going to find a way to abuse them and get
exactly.
high. Okay.
So here's the thing, is that addicts are pretty resourceful. Even OxyContin, as many people know, was invented as a drug that couldn't be tampered with. A drug that we weren't going to have an addiction problem with. And guess what? Bingo. As soon as it gets out there, yeah, we've got an addiction problem. And so that's the kind of thing where we have to realize that that is going to happen. And what we have to do is reduce the consequences. We don't want people dying of overdose. We don't want young people whose lives are in front of them to die of overdose. So why don't we act to prevent overdose deaths? Why don't we try to minimize the harm of the entire drug economy every way we can? Go ahead and use some law enforcement, criminalize some of those behaviors, but decriminalize other behaviors. That's what I'm arguing for.
You're a student of history. Our politicians, who I deal with all the time, are they likely to take the chance to do what you're saying? I doubt it.
They're unlikely to be students of history themselves. And it is interesting to me, the pendulum, right? This drug, U.S. drug policy has oscillated between criminalization and medicalization and back and forth throughout the 20th century. Now, I think we're beginning to see that there are problems with going to the extreme end of either one of those. And that's where I am. I think that we really need to think about, okay, so what are we going to criminalize and what are we going to keep criminal and what are we going to medicalize and what are we going to say, this is what we want our public health messages to be. I don't think that telling certain population groups that they're expendable, that we don't care what happens to them, that we don't care if they die young, is a good public health message. I would rather see us putting out a message that says it matters to us as a country, as a society, that we get straight around drug policy, that we make it more rational, because currently there are great irrationalities in the system, that we make it really better for the most vulnerable groups. Because we're talking about vulnerable populations, Alan. I mean, people who really have a lot stacked against them, right? There's a lot stacked against the folks who you're driving by on the way into work. Why don't we do whatever we can to reduce the number of things that they've got stacked against them? That's where I think we ought to be as a society.
Our guest is the fabulous Dr. Nancy D. Campbell, professor in the Department of Science and Technology Studies and associate dean for graduate studies and research at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Nancy, I could talk to you all day and probably several other days about this. You were terrific. I appreciate your coming in and spending all this time with us.
Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.